Well, hey there, everybody. Welcome to another week of Cambridge Inside Out. I should say another month of Cambridge Inside Out since last time we it was just pardon me while I'm actually doing just a little bit of goofiness here. So last week it was 2 weeks ago it was too many things, because of my job at Harvard Extension School. So we just bagged the week or that show. So anyway, we're back now. Today's what today's May 21st, year of our Lord 2024, a few things to say. All right. So first thing I was gonna just mention, other than the fact that I'm glad my final exams have all been graded and course grades have been submitted, and I can now actually get about 4 or 5 weeks of vacation time before teaching in the summer school. But there are a few things that are coming up in the short term that I thought maybe I could share with people here. Actually, the first thing I'm going to do is just mention here that last Friday, I usually like to go to this myself, but I was unable to make this one, which is the City of Cambridge makes the awards for the Outstanding City Employee Awards, as well as the Brian Murphy Award for Leadership in the Workplace and Public Service. It was a pretty nice array of city employees, Cambridge City employees. Some of my own personal favorites. Some of my favorites. I don't want to name everybody here, but Alyssa Pacey, who's worked with us very much, and when we were producing our video production about the history of the city charter, Alyssa Pacey, definitely one of my favorites. Definitely one of my favorite city employees. Ranger Tim up at Fresh Pond, Kara Seiderman from Community Development, certainly, but really everybody. And I think it must have apparently skipped a year with the Brian Murphy Awards, because I was noted. I took a picture of the plaque where they have all the names, and they stopped at 2022. But Lisa Dobertine, who was really doing tremendous work during COVID, was awarded it for the year 2023. And Charlie Sullivan, from the executive director from the Cambridge Historical Commission, for 2024. This year, Charlie also was very helpful as we prepared our documentary for on the history of the city charter. By the way, I might as well just mention this as sort of a bit of a plug here, which is that it's kind of a funny thing. I'm actually having a hard time seeing myself on the screen here, so I'll make do. Anyway, we're actually going to get recognized, thankfully, for finally, for the work John Pitkin and I put in making that documentary, which we premiered that a year ago now, actually on May 15th, 2023. And there's the Historic Preservation Awards from the Historical Commission are May 30th. I forget exactly where the location is, so we're at least going to get some recognition. I'm really appreciative of that fact. From Charlie Sullivan and all the good people from the Cambridge Historical Commission. So that was a great thing. So some other things that are of some significance since we last met in this program was that it's been all over the national news is the story of these Harvard encampments, Harvard and MIT encampments of the people who are protesting Israel's presence in Gaza, which of course happened after the Hamas invasion of Israel in early October. And I was a little unsure how that was all going to resolve, especially with commencements coming up. The MIT commence, actually, the Harvard commencement is this coming Thursday. It's just 2 days away. And I'm not really sure whether there's going to be any action associated with that, because I think that Harvard managed to negotiate some sort of a settlement where everybody cleared out, but then and then the president Garber said that he would recommend that there be great leniency to some of the more egregious characters who were involved in the encampments there. But then the administrative board came back and issued some suspensions. And apparently I saw yesterday the Harvard faculty voted by a very lopsided vote that no, you should just let the people who are ready to graduate, let them graduate and do all that. But we'll see what happens on Thursday, whether some of them decide that this is a good opportunity to make a scene again. You know, the MIT encampment ended in a somewhat different fashion. I was actually going down there, maybe taking a few pictures here and there, and just sort of see how things are going. And it was a little on the weird side. The encampment was one thing. There were a lot of pro-Israel party students, some of whom I knew. One of whom was a former freshman advisee of mine when I worked down there. They basically surrounded the camp with pro-Israel things, so which led then to some attempts to tear down the fencing around that. I was there Thursday before last, and there was an action over by the parking garage where people exit onto the Vassar Street parking garage, and they were basically trying to block people from going home. And the police were trying to clear them out, and they were scuffles. I mean, they were actually, I mean, depending on how you define assault, they were assaulting police officers. And I thought, okay, this is not going to end well. So there were, I think there were five or nine, maybe actually, I'm not sure how many arrests took place. I actually took some photos of people in real handcuffs, not just the zip ties. Which was kind of interesting. But I watched, you know, as they were really pushing at the police, and then the police were pushing back just because people were trying to get out of the parking garage, and there were scuffles. And I thought, this is not going to end well. And that night, I think 6 a.m. the following morning, state police and others were involved in clearing out the encampment and making some arrests. And, you know, no matter what your politics are, the moment you start assaulting police officers, I think you've kind of crossed every reasonable line. So I thought that was really the only course of action at that point. So anyway, I don't really know. I know that some MIT students were suspended. They were kicked out of their housing, and the MIT commencement is not this week, but next week. And we'll see what that brings. You know, unlike Harvard Yard, which could be nicely enclosed, the MIT campus is quite open, and it's much more difficult to prevent trouble. So I think that's kind of why there was more trouble actually down there on the MIT campus. But we'll see. You know, it's I'm just sort of hoping to let. I will also mention, since, you know, I teach mathematics class at Harvard Extension School, I had some real concerns because the encampments were right near where I teach. And my students actually had to show IDs because they're not a lot of them aren't registered Harvard students because it's extension school. So they had to kind of prove that they went to class. And I was concerned that I would be teaching to an empty classroom because, you know, it's broadcast, but, you know, nobody wants to teach to an empty room. But fortunately, by the last week, and the encampments actually had gone all the way right up to Harvard Hall. So I said, oh, this could get very weird, but it didn't. It worked out okay. And I was able to do my last class, which is always a joy, you know, for the semester. Students take photos with you and everything. It's really great, actually. So that went off without a hitch. I was thankful for that. Anyway, we'll see where this goes. You know, I think we're also hoping that the situation in the Middle East resolves in some way, somehow, soon enough. But who knows, you know, what's going on there, especially with the news of the president of Iran going down in a helicopter crash the other day. By the way, there was one quote I'm going to say here, which I thought, you know, again, I don't usually like to talk about all this international stuff, but I thought that it was a particularly telling quote from a gentleman named Salman Rushdie, who I think everyone should know, who basically said this. He said, you know, he was noting all the protesters' demands to, quote, liberate Palestine. And he sort of said but if there were a Palestinian state now, it would be run by Hamas, and we would have a Taliban-like state, a satellite state of Iran. Is this what the progressive movements of the Western left want to create? He said. And I thought, that's That's really kind of says it all. I mean, are people really aware of what they're advocating? I mean, that's what it comes down to, at least in my reading of things. That's really what it comes down to. All right. Anyway, back to Cambridge, good old Cambridge, Massachusetts. So one of the things that happens this time of year is the city council and the city administration go through the entire, it's really kind of like a ritual of the budget hearings. You know, technically it's the finance committee, a subcommittee of the Cambridge City Council that conducts the meetings, and then they make recommendations to forward the budgets of the various city departments to the full city council, which consists of exactly the same nine people because it's a committee of the whole. But that's the process. So they have one set of hearings for roughly half of the city departments that are under one category. And then they have a single meeting just on the school department budget. And then the following week, they come back and they do, yeah, I think the first one was largely focused on all the public safety and that general government stuff. And the other one included things like, you know, finance departments and stuff like that. And I thought that was actually going to be somewhat controversial because we do have a bit of a, we do have a sort of a fiscal situation that I don't think people fully are, you know, and the members of the public are really fully understanding what's going on. So I thought maybe I would speak to it just a little bit. So you know, there were loan authorizations that were actually usually they're just passed to a second reading, and then they're voted on June 3rd, which is the date of the scheduled budget adoption. But they also this time they've referred them to the Finance Committee, which suggested that some of them were going to be called into question. Now, I'm not so sure that any of them really were called into question, but I thought it was sort of a cautionary thing because, unlike many of the past years, we actually have some fiscal constraints on the horizon right now. You know, the budget, our budget has been growing faster than inflation, tis true. But, you know, we had new development that basically offsets some of it. Yes, residential taxes were going up, except for condominium owners who still get the sweetest deal in town. But things have kind of accelerated, and you know, you can blame things on COVID if you want, but honestly, this is something that's a little bit bigger. You know, the city has been saying yes a lot more to some big capital projects. There were contract negotiations with the school department, which led to some significant increases. We're about to and fund universal pre-K programs, you know, for young people in the city. And you know, there's a cost associated with all of this, you know, and we also continue to pump a lot of money, no longer just out of Community Preservation Act funds, but out of the general government funds now toward affordable housing initiatives of various sorts. And I will remind everybody that every stick of affordable housing never pays its way in terms of tax revenue. So every unit of affordable housing is a permanent built-in debt that is paid for by taxpayers every year till the end of time. So anyway, when you add up the cumulative effect of all of this stuff, it basically put us in a position where we were going to see something in the order of a 10% increase in the expected in the tax levy. And the amount of commercial growth has slowed. So the new growth, which is exempt from Prop 2.5 limits, you know, other than they bring in the Volpe project online, there that's it's limited. It's just plain limited. And the I would say that the biggest potential effect here, which is it's not like we're voting needing to vote for overrides or some of the other things, you know, or cutting back programs in dramatic ways like they do in other cities and towns, but what really happens here, especially when you have residential property values rising at a certain rate, commercial values are basically flat. And what that means under the way the laws work is that there's a potential for a shift onto the residential sector. And since condominium owners, because of residential exemption, the math of it all will not get much of an effect, what it means is that you may very well see a very dramatic increase in tax bills come October for single family, two family, three family homeowners. So again, it's not like we're about to bust the bank or having to watch our free cash whittle away. No, I think the real crisis, if you want to call it a crisis, I just think it's a problem, is the potential shot sticker shock that may come in the fall to some residential property owners. So, this ultimately it's all based on what the budget is. So if we're passing a $1 billion budget, which we are, then that's got to be paid for. And if the commercial properties aren't going to cover all of it, then we got to cover it. So anyway, that's a bit of a situation. A lot of other things happening around now too, in addition to the budget and that. There was a actually, I think maybe I'll mention one, which was this really the big kerfuffle of the day, was there was I'm just switching over here a little bit here. There was on April 8th, I believe, yes, April 8th, there was two city council orders introduced. One called for modifications of the PTDM ordinance. That's parking traffic demand management. I mean, I may have spoken about this on the last time we did a program, to allow more flexibility for the use of privately owned parking to accommodate some of the city's needs, basically in, under arrangements, and really done to address the problem of some of the spillover effects of some of the separated bike lane construction coupled with dedicated bus lanes and loss of parking, right? There were some other reasons why there was some concerns about this. So there were two orders. One had to do with modifications to the parking and traffic demand management ordinance. But that was really coupled with a proposed modification of the cycling safety ordinance, which, if you remember, for those who were signing pledges as candidates, I thou shalt not change the cycle safety ordinance under any circumstance. This was a proposed change to delay the implementation on Cambridge Street, Broadway, and one other street while they worked out some of these details. I mean, down the road there may be some other modifications proposed as well, but that's basically what was going on there. And it caused a tremendous amount of controversy. And because there was Patriots Day, another holiday, so the next meeting after April 8th wasn't until April, what was it, 29th? So there was it was really kind of it's kind of funny in a way, but there were. I mean, I don't remember there being more than a few hundred communications to the city council. Maybe it was one time it was some boilerplate thing on some international nonsense some months ago, but it maybe got up to the 300 range or something now. So there were 744 communications to the city council on the city council agenda, which included things like a petition with 22 pages of signatures. So you can add all of those signatures to the 744 communications. So it was probably like on the order of 1,000 messages being sent to the city council. And some of them were saying like, yes, please delay things. We need to work this out and get it right, which is more or less where I stand. And then many of the other ones were very, very much of the old, please do not delay anything. If you do, everybody's going to die. And then on April 29th, they had the city council meeting where that was going to come to a vote. And yeah, Patty Nolan was the deciding vote, and it was 5-4 to allow the delay. Patty, I think, very admirably explained her position, and nobody should fault her for her vote. But this is a pretty hostile crowd. So social media was already the following, even before the night was done, they were already threatening vengeance against Councillor Nolan, you traitorous whatever, which was really, really unfair. I mean, the dramatic theatrics that took place at that meeting, it was really stunning. you know, and all basically conveying the orchestrated message that if you change anything, the world will end, everybody's going to die. And it was all ridiculous, quite honestly. But anyway, it ended. And after the meeting, there were people continued to write letters, so that by the following meeting, which I guess was May 6, there was another 452 communications. So it's they're like number one and number two, I think, in number of communications, sent to the city council, almost all of which are all about bike lanes, you know. And it is a sort of a sad state of affairs that it seems like the only two issues in Cambridge are whether you want to build more public housing or bike lanes, you know. And it's like everything else is completely secondary afterthoughts, it seems. Even some of the proposals right now where they were going to reconfigure Carl Baron Plaza as part of the River Street reconstruction. If you actually look at the proposal, you know, for this newly reconfigured Carl Baron Plaza, basically all it is a bike lane with some extra things, or, you know, dressing it up, you know, quite honestly. So I kind of hope someday we can move beyond this, but, you know, we're not there yet. I'll tell you that much. All right. Just a few other things that I'll mention. Oh yeah. I forgot to write this down, but I'll mention it. There was a city council order. I think it might've been on May 6th as well, which was related to the whole, the encampments, you know, not to go back to that here, but where there was an order introduced, made subject to the charter right, but then it came to a vote at the following meeting, where they didn't want the Cambridge police to have any involvement whatsoever in enforcing anything at any of these encampments. Of course, you know, I actually was really quite delightful that the city manager, you know, clearly well advised by the police commissioner and the law department, made a really, really excellent statement explaining about under mutual aid agreements how, in fact, Cambridge Police Department is obliged to help out if there's a situation that absolutely requires it. So by the time they finally did pass an order, basically, you know, trying to suggest that maybe Cambridge police should try not to be involved, they had to put in a clause that said, yes, with the full recognition that maybe they have to be, you know. But in the end, all that's kind of out the window when police officers start getting assaulted. So yes, so they were involved, and the sky did not fall, you know, and I thought that worked out just fine. All right. Another issue that's sort of on the horizon now, it's sort of growing, there's an actual zoning petition, I might have mentioned this on the last program, called the Ronayne petition, which chooses to allow higher densities citywide, to allow multifamily homes pretty much in all residential zones. But, you know, there's almost like a one-upmanship game going on here. So after that gets introduced, there's a housing committee meeting chaired with, the principal proponents here were Mr. Azeem and Ms. Siddiqui, who basically want to not only allow multifamily buildings in all residential zones, which most of us find perfectly okay, but they also want to make the allowable heights and densities. They basically want to make all residential zones zoned identically, basically so that every residential zone would have a zoning and allowable heights and densities comparable to some of the denser streets in East Cambridge. You know, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, I mean, I personally like the idea of allowing multifamily homes everywhere. I mean, I own a multifamily home. I'm kind of a fan of multifamily homes, but I have to say, I personally like the diversity of the housing stock in the city. I like the fact that, you know, if you go to other parts of the city, you might actually find people who have backyards and that have a different kind of neighborhood feel. I even like the fact that there are some kind of estate-like things along Brattle Street that are, you know, kind of amazing, you know. And I'm kind of proud of the fact that Cambridge houses, or at least it hosts enough of a variety of housing stock So that, if you want to live in a particular kind of neighborhood with a particular level of density, whatever, you can do that. Problem with is like the Azeem Siddiqui world and the ABC puppet masters call for some of these things. They are doing everything they can to try and convince everybody that Cambridge zoning is nothing but the legacy of racism and classism and everything under the sun, which in fact, if you actually do a little research, you never mind what's happened elsewhere in the country, because zoning laws have been abused elsewhere. But if you actually look at the history of Cambridge zoning, you'll see it's a very different story, But you would never know that to listen to the rhetoric or the prompted communications all about this one here. So, but now, I think the ABC group actually put out a message to its disciples. Please urge your counselors to do nothing on the Ronayne petition, because don't you know we've got to do ours here, which is going to allow much higher densities. And basically, they were even suggesting you could build six-story apartment buildings in all of these zones, and then make them all be subject to inclusionary zoning. So you sort of turn a lot of these zones into something more of affordable housing complexes. And and even some of the proponents of affordable housing are saying, hold on, don't you know we just rigged the whole system a year ago to allow to maintain suppressed heights and densities in residential zones so that we could allow this skewed allowance for the affordable housing overlay projects. So if you allow more heights and densities citywide, then basically you're defeating that skewing, is the argument that they make. To which the response that comes back from the Azeem world is, well, we'll just have to go to AHO 3.0 and allow even higher heights and densities for those. So it becomes almost like a game of Monte Carlo, where it's just, we'll just keep betting higher and higher and higher until somebody wins or everybody loses. So anyway, I think this is all heading down a terrible, terrible road. And I kind of wish that we could kind of pull back a little bit here and actually rethink it. But problem is, I think that there's a little bit of Azeem and others in being in cahoots with some of the people within the community development department, or at least the portion of it that's about to get split off and become their own separate housing department. I'm not happy that city councilors are basically colluding with city staff in that particular way. Anyway, we'll see where it goes. As I say, I'm just not particularly happy about it. So anyway, I'm just going to take my usual artificial 10-second break here and be back for part two in a few seconds.